holed up in the library, working on my dissertation. My advisors and I had agreed that it should explore how families cope with poverty, specifically how CHA tenants solve problems and kept the community together without much help from the government or charities. When I arrived for the party, it felt like my first visits from years earlier. There were cars parked all around the basketball court, rap music blasting away, kids running everywhere, and squatters grilling burgers and hot dogs to earn a little money. JT and his senior officers were drinking beer and casting an eye over the entire scene. JT, Ms. May, Ms. Bailey, and some of the other tenants greeted me with the same carefree attitude they had showed me when I first began coming around. As I watched Ms. Bailey and some of the other older women tend to the children, I couldn't help but feel kind of nostalgic. Everyone looked a bit older and more fatigued, just like me, I suppose. I saw something out of the corner of my eye that stopped me cold. A small garden bursting with bright orange, red, and purple geraniums. In this vast stretch of concrete and patchy lawn, littered with broken bottles, used condoms, and empty crack vials, here was an oasis. I laughed to myself. Why hadn't I ever noticed it before? I'd been so caught up with gangs, political chicanery, and the life of poverty that I had missed something so beautiful right there in front of me. What else had I missed because of my incessant drive to hustle? I thought back to the last time I noticed any flowers in Robert Taylor. It had been well over a year earlier. The tenants were preparing for a visit from President Bill Clinton. They were incredibly excited, but also unnerved. His visit was meant to highlight the unprecedented levels of gang violence in Chicago public housing. Clinton supported the use of police sweeps, the warrantless searches that the Chicago Police Department was using to combat the gang and drug problems. While the ACLU and other groups decried the sweeps as a violation of constitutional rights, Clinton argued that the right to freedom from fear was more important. He wanted inner-city residents to believe, as he believed, that the scourge of street gangs required extraordinary measures, and his trip to Robert Taylor provided a first-hand opportunity to persuade them. In the weeks before his visit, the project was turned upside down. The police conducted even more sweeps than usual, sometimes ransacking apartments indiscriminately. They also conducted random spot checks in the building lobbies, arresting a great many suspected drug dealers, including many young men who had nothing whatsoever to do with dealing drugs. JT didn't go so far as to halt drug sales, but he was a bit more cautious, sometimes having his dealers take customers inside to an apartment to obtain the drugs, rather than getting them on the street. He also stopped extorting from local stores, fearing that that might lead to arrest. And he stopped laundering money, stowing his cash in garbage bags until the neighborhood quieted down. On the streets, city tow trucks hauled away abandoned vehicles, as well as a lot of vehicles that might have looked abandoned, but were in fact just old and beat up. On top of all this disorder, the weather was unrelentingly hot and humid. Still, there was hope in the air. Because of Bill Clinton's overwhelming popularity among African Americans, even the most cynical tenants, including the people whose cars had been towed, were excited about his visit. Tenant leaders led campaigns to spruce up their buildings' lobbies, hallways, and playgrounds. Tenant patrols went door-to-door asking people to tidy up their living rooms and clean their toilets. In one building, snakes and other strange pets were confiscated from certain households. And throughout the project, aged flower beds sprang to life. In the early days of Robert Taylor, the buildings had competed against one another with flower gardens and other beautification projects. This dormant practice was now reborn in anticipation of the president's visit. He obviously couldn't visit all 28 Robert Taylor buildings, and he might have time for just one. But this only heightened the intensity of the competition. A few tenant leaders called in favors with city officials to try to make sure their building was on the president's list. Some of them curried additional favor by turning in drug dealers to the police. The 5011 building, located on the far south side of Robert Taylor, showed particular enthusiasm. This was fueled by the belief that a new construction project next door to 5011 was in fact the construction of a presidential podium. The tenant leader taxed the local gang $2,500 to fund a wide-scale restoration effort. The building's children were given new clothes and shoes. A mural of historic African-American figures was painted along the building's ground floor. A few particularly civic-minded tenants even wrote speeches, just in case the president called them up to the podium. And families planted rows and rows of flowers in a garden that had seen nothing but trash for years. By the morning of June 17, 1994, the day of President Clinton's visit, the residents of 5011 were fully ready. But his entourage sped past quickly, without so much as a wave. He gave his speech in another part of Robert Taylor. A few of the tenants in 5011 moaned and groaned, but generally they were satisfied that the president had showed up at all. Parents broke out soda and beer, and their kids caught the spirit and launched a party. After the initial disappointment, no one seemed willing to utter a spiteful word. For a time, at least, the community shared a deep spirit of satisfaction, of having pulled together. Over and over again, you could hear tenants remark that they hadn't seen such solidarity in decades. Now, a year later, the flower bed outside JT's building stood as a similar sign of hope, and in light of the imminent demolition of the projects, a sign of proud obstinacy. The back-to-school party was in full swing. Kids and grown-ups alike loaded their plates with food. A softball game started up, and a crowd of people gathered to watch. I milled about, saying hello to a lot of people I hadn't seen in a while. Suddenly, the sound of gunshots pierced the air, and everyone ran for cover. There were four or five shots, rapid fire, from what sounded like a pistol. Parents grabbed their kids and ducked behind cars or ran for the lobby. Above the blaring music, you could hear women screaming for their children. JT hollered for everyone to get down. I found myself crouching behind a car parked near the building. Beside me were a few of JT's foot soldiers, young men I barely knew. I asked where the shooting was coming from. They immediately pointed up toward the upper floors of the building. "Niggers are probably high on dope," one of them whispered, "or else you got an MC who snuck up in the building. It used to be an MC building before we took it over." Some distance away, I could see a thin, dark-skinned woman staggering toward us across the grassy expanse in front of the building. Her clothes were sloppy, and she was practically falling down, probably either drunk or high. As she came closer, you could hear her talking to herself, most of it gibberish. People started yelling at her to take cover. A few of JT's men shouted nasty names and threw beer bottles at her. It was pretty common for drug dealers to treat drug users with disdain. They often justified their line of work by pointing out that they took money from the most useless members of the community. Some more shots rang out from above, the bullets kicking up clouds of dirt a few feet from the woman. "That ain't the MCs firing at us," said the foot soldier beside me. "That's just some nigger who is fucked up and looking to cause trouble." Finally, an older gentleman ran out, grabbed the staggering woman, and hustled her into the lobby. After about 10 minutes, with no more gunfire, most people felt comfortable enough to come out from their hiding places. Parents and children ran into the building, abandoning the party. The squatters and the hustlers, meanwhile, got back to their food and listened to the music. My heart kept racing for several minutes, but even I wasn't surprised by now that nobody even bothered to call the police. In the spring of 1996, I learned that I had received a junior fellowship at Harvard's Society of Fellows. I was ecstatic. It was a much-sought-after position, a 3-year salaried research post. I went to tell JT the good news and that I would soon be leaving town, although I still planned to maintain my ties to Chicago. The smells of Ms. May's cooking, collard greens, cornbread, and smothered chicken, hit me as I walked in the door. "You still manage to get here right when the food is ready, don't you?" JT said with a laugh. I apologize for missing the last few Suburban Black Kings meetings. "They still think you're the director of communications," he said, laughing again but looking at the TV instead of at me. "There's another meeting next Sunday if you want to come with me." "Sure," I said, trying to sound enthusiastic. "That would be great." I explained why I'd been so busy lately. Until I learned of the Harvard Fellowship, I had been applying for teaching jobs at universities all over the country, including Columbia University in New York. JT interrupted my explanation. "You remember Curtis, that tall, dark boy you met?" He suddenly sat up and began to speak with great enthusiasm. "Curtis is from New Jersey, or at least he has work out there. Hey, what do you think about heading out there with me? I've been wanting to go and see how they do things. He and I have this bet. He says the women are hotter in his projects. Says I should come out and see." I did remember Curtis, a nerdy-looking drug dealer who worked out of the housing projects in Newark. We had exchanged a few words at most when he came to visit JT about a year earlier. "Somehow," I said to JT, trying to sound appreciative. "I don't think that would be such a good..." "Yeah, you're probably right. Probably not the best time for us to leave right now, especially with everything that's going on. You need to watch me do my thing, I know." He grew pensive. "I got a couple of big meetings next week, and you probably want to be around for that." Before I could ask him about these meetings, he had another idea. "You know something? You remember how we talked about how gangs are different across the country? I had once told JT that gangs in New York and Boston were said to be much smaller than Chicago's gangs, rooted in local neighborhoods as opposed to being part of a citywide wheel. But no one, I told him, had managed to write an in-depth, multi-city study of street gangs. I could help you meet people all over the place, he continued. He stood up to get a beer from the fridge. We got people we know in L.A., in Las Vegas, St. Louis. Black kings are nationwide. I mean, you and I could figure out how the whole thing works. So you'll be my research assistant? I said with a laugh, not quite sure what he was proposing. No, you'll still be writing about me. The book will still be about me, but this will add a new dimension to it. Yes, it would add a lot, but I'd really have to check with my professors. I mean, I'm not sure what's going to happen once I move. JT's voice immediately took on a guarded tone. No, I understand, he said. I know you got a lot to think about. I'm just saying that I could help you, but yeah, you talk to your professors first, no big thing. We sat there, not speaking, eyes on the TV. I kept hoping we'd be interrupted by Ms. May calling us for dinner, but we weren't. I didn't even have the energy to muster up a question about JT's business or his life, as I'd always done previously whenever he sensed that my interests were shifting. Finally, a college basketball game came on, and the blare of the crowd and the cheerleaders drowned out the silence between us. With the demolition of Robert Taylor now formally scheduled to begin within a year, the drug economy in JT's buildings was already faltering. Some of his best customers were tenants, and they were starting to move out. So were a lot of the BK foot soldiers who still lived at home with their moms. JT offered to rent Ms. May a home in one of several neighborhoods, and she tried out a few, but she wound up coming back to a cousin's house a few hundred yards from Robert Taylor. The whole place had also grown thick with police, called in to protect the streams of contractors, engineers, city planners, and other bureaucrats who were plotting the massive demolition. With less demand for drugs, there was less work for JT's rank-and-file members. It was in his interest to place these young men in a new gang, since he never knew when he might need their help in the future. Given his standing in the BKs, it was certainly within JT's power to reassign his foot soldiers to other BK factions throughout the city. But he was able to place only a handful at a time, and no more than a few dozen overall. Worse yet, this strategy tended to fail in the long term, since in most cases the host gang wouldn't fully accept the new member. JT's gang also had a lot of older members, in their 30s and even 40s, who were unwilling to accept a transfer, since that typically meant a drop in seniority and, accordingly, income. Some of these men began to leave JT's command altogether, trying to secure positions within other gangs around the city, occasionally, to JT's deep displeasure, within a rival gang. A few of JT's men traveled as far as Iowa to try to set up shop. I never went along on any of these out-of-state recruiting trips, but judging from the frustration of the BK missionaries who returned to Chicago, this plan wasn't going to work out very well. JT tried to hold things together, but the new economics of his situation conspired against him. He grew lonely, feeling as if he were being abandoned by his own BK family. His sense of paranoia grew even more acute. Whenever I saw him, he immediately began to speculate that the more senior BK defectors were revealing the gang's secrets to rival outfits. Where the BKs stored guns and drugs, which cops were open to bribery, which local merchants were willing to launder money. And then there were the arrests. The federal indictments that had begun to tear apart other gangs were now striking the Black Kings as well. Barry and Otis, two of JT's younger members, had recently been arrested. I wondered how long JT would be able to stay free himself. One night, driving back from one of the suburban gang meetings, he mused that jail might actually be the best of his options, since anyone who escaped arrest for too long was suspected of being a snitch and placed himself in real danger on the streets. Soon after this conversation, I heard that T-Bone had been arrested. He was eventually convicted of trafficking narcotics and sentenced to more than 10 years in prison. His prompt transfer to an out-of-state prison fueled speculation that he was testifying against his peers to get a reduced sentence. I tried every avenue I could think of, but I had no luck reaching T-Bone. I eventually heard that he had died in prison, and he became celebrated in death for never having cooperated with the police to sell out other gang members. For a time, I thought that JT and I might remain close, even as our worlds were growing apart. "Don't worry," I told him, "I'll be coming back all the time." But the deeper I got into my Harvard fellowship, the more time passed between my visits to Chicago, and the more time passed between visits, the more awkward JT and I found it to carry on our conversations. He seemed to have grown nostalgic for our early days together, even a bit clingy. I realized he had come to rely on my presence. He liked the attention and the validation. I, meanwhile, grew evasive and withdrawn, in large part out of guilt. Within just a few months at Harvard, I began making a name for myself in academia by talking about the inner workings of street gangs. While I hoped to contribute to the national discussion on poverty, I was not so foolish as to believe that my research would specifically benefit JT, or the tenant families from whom I'd learned so much. As demolition became a reality, and as JT's gang continued to fall apart, so did our relationship. When I told him that I'd been offered a job teaching sociology at Columbia University upon completing my Harvard fellowship, he asked me what was wrong with teaching in Chicago. "What about high school?" he said. "Those people need education too, don't they?" The breakdown of the gang affected Ms. Bailey as well. When the gang didn't make any money, Ms. Bailey didn't make much money either. And with demolition so near, she needed all the money she could get to help the tenants she wanted to help. She paid for daycare so single mothers could go look for new apartments. She hired a car service to take tenants on their housing searches. She helped others settle their outstanding electricity bills so they'd be able to get service once they entered the private market. But as the money ran out, some tenants began to turn on her. Even though the CHA was supposed to provide relocation services, it was Ms. Bailey who had stepped into the breach, for a fee, and so she was the one who now caught the blame. She was widely accused of pocketing the gang's money instead of using it for the tenants. I had never seen Ms. Bailey cry until the moment she told me about these accusations. "I have lived here for almost my whole life, Sudhir," she said mournfully. We were sitting in her office on a hot spring day. The old bustle was long gone. It used to be that we couldn't sit and talk for 10 minutes before Ms. Bailey was interrupted by a needy tenant. Now we had the room to ourselves for well over an hour. "You've been told before that you work too closely with the gangs," I said. "Why does it bother you now?" "Out there, they don't have anybody," she said. "Out there, they think they can make it on their own, but..." She tried and tried, but she wasn't able to finish her sentence. I wanted to say something worthwhile, but couldn't think of anything. They'll be okay," I sputtered. "Hell, they live through the projects." "But you see, Sudhir, I know that, and you know that, but they sometimes forget. It's like I told you many times, what scares you ain't what scares them. When they go to a new store, or they have to stand at a bus stop in a place they'd never been to before, that's what scares them. I wanted to help them feel okay, and just when they need me, I can't be there for them." "You can still do things," I started to say, but I stopped. The pain on her face was evident, and nothing I could say would console her. I just sat quietly with her until we'd finished our coffee. I saw Ms. Bailey a few more times, but she was never again the same. For health reasons, she moved into her nephew's home in the middle of West Englewood, a poor black community about 2 miles from the projects. I visited her there. She had several ailments, she told me, but it was hard to sort one out from the other. "I stopped going to the doctors," she said. "One more test, one more drug, one more thing I gotta pay for. And for what, to live here?" She waved her hands out at the miles and miles of poor tracks surrounding her nephew's house, tracks that held far too few of the people from her old high-rise home, the people who'd once given her life meaning. Winter in Chicago comes fast, and it comes hard. The cold delivers a wallop, making you shudder longer than you'd expect. The first blasts of chilling wind off the lake feel like an enemy. It was a late Sunday morning in November 1998, and I was waiting outside JT's building one last time. About a half dozen Robert Taylor buildings had already been torn down, and his was due for demolition within a year. Nearby businesses had started to close, too. The whole place was starting to feel like a ghost town. I had changed as well. Gone were the tie-dyed shirts and the ponytail, replaced by the kinds of clothes befitting an edgy young Ivy League professor, and also a leather briefcase. I leaned against my car, stamping my feet to keep warm while waiting for JT. I was just about to get back into the car and turn on the heater when I saw his Malibu charge down Federal Street. JT had called the night before to request a meeting. In his characteristically ambiguous way, he wouldn't divulge any details, but he sounded excited. He did tell me that the federal indictments were probably over and that he wouldn't be arrested. I wanted to know how and why he had escaped arrest, but I didn't have the guts to ask. He'd always been secretive about his contacts in law enforcement. He also asked a few questions about what kind of research I'd be doing in New York. I mentioned some possible ideas, but they were vague at best. We greeted each other with a handshake and a smile. I told him he'd look like he'd put on a little weight. He agreed. Between his work and the needs of his growing children, he said, there wasn't as much time to exercise. He pulled a small piece of paper from his pocket and handed it to me. There were several names and phone numbers printed in JT's scratchy handwriting. Among the names was that of Curtis, the gang leader in Newark we'd talked about before. "You should call these people," JT said. "I told Curtis that you wanted to see how things worked out there. He'll take care of you. But Billy Joe, that's the one who really knows what's happening in New York. Here, give him this." JT had often talked about his friends who ran drug dealing operations in New York. But what with the federal indictments, the demolition of Robert Taylor, and my own career moves, I had pretty much forgotten about them. Also, given how things had turned out with me and JT, it was pretty obvious by now that I wasn't going to write his biography. I was surprised that he'd go out of his way to put me in touch with his contacts back east. He took out another sheet of paper, tightly folded over in fours, the creases a bit worn, as if he'd been carrying it in his pocket for a while. His hands were so cold that they shook as he unfolded it. He gave the paper to me and blew on his hands to warm them up. "Go ahead, nigger, read it," he said. "Hurry up, it's cold." I began to read. It was addressed to Billy Joe. "Billy, Sudhir is coming your way. Take care of the nigger." My eyes scanned down and caught a phrase in the middle of the page. "He's with me." I could feel myself breaking into a wide smile. JT reached into his car and pulled out two beers. "I'm not sure I'm ready for another big research project just yet," I said. "Oh yeah?" he said, handing me one of the beers. "What else are you going to do? You can't fix nothing. You never worked a day in your life. The only thing you know how to do is hang out with niggers like us." I nearly choked on my beer when he summarized my capacity so succinctly, and for the most part accurately. JT leaned back on his car, looking up at the high-rises in front of us. "You think niggers will survive out there?" he asked. "You think they'll be all right when they leave here?" "Not sure, probably. I mean, everything changes. You just have to be ready, I guess." "You hungry?" he asked. "Starving. Let's go down to 79th. There's a new soul food place." "Sounds good," I said, chugging the beer quickly. "Why don't you drive?" "Oh, yeah," he said, jumping into the car. "And I got one for you. What would you do if you were me? I got this new bunch of guys that think they know everything." He began telling me about his latest management dilemma with a gang he was running in Roseland, a neighborhood where a lot of the Robert Taylor families were relocating. As he spoke, I became lost in his voice. His steady and assured monologue comforted me. For a few moments, anyway, I could feel as though little had changed, even though everything had. He turned on some rap music, opened up another beer, and kept on talking. The car screeched out of the parking lot. JT waved to a few women pushing strollers in the cold, and we sped down Federal Street. Within a few years, JT grew tired of running a gang. He managed his cousin's dry-cleaning business, and he started up a barber shop, which failed. He had put away enough savings in property and cash to supplement his lower income. Once in a while, he did consulting work for Black King's higher-ups, who tried to revive their citywide hold on the drug economy. But this effort never came to fruition, and with the crack market severely depleted, Chicago's gangland remains fragmented, with some neighborhoods having little, if any, gang activity. I still see JT now and then when I'm in Chicago. Although we've never discussed it explicitly, I don't sense that he begrudges my success as an academic, nor does he seem bitter about his own life. "Man, as long as I'm not behind bars and breathing," he told me, "every day is a good day." It would be hard to call us friends, and I sometimes wonder if we ever were. But he was obviously a huge part of my life. For all the ways in which I had become a rogue sociologist, breaking conventions and flouting the rules, perhaps the most unconventional thing I ever did was embrace the idea that I could learn so much, absorb so many lessons, and gain so many experiences at the side of a man who was so far removed from my academic world. I can still hear JT's voice when I'm on the streets far away from Chicago, somewhere in the unruly Paris suburbs or the ghettos of New York, hanging around and listening to people's stories. Author's note. Many of the names and some of the identities in this book have been changed. I also disguised some locations and altered the titles of certain organizations. But all the people, places, and institutions are real. They are not composites, and they are not fictional. Whenever possible, I base the material on written field notes. Some of the stories, however, have been reconstructed from memory. While memory isn't a perfect substitute for notes, I have tried my best to reproduce conversations and events as faithfully as possible. Acknowledgements. There is one basic truth in the South Asian immigrant experience: do as your parents tell you. This notion was put to test during my junior year of college when I informed my father and mother that I wanted to study sociology. My mother seemed agnostic, but such decisions were made by my father, who said he preferred that I stay on the path toward a degree in bioengineering. I was not interested in science, and after several conversations, we reached a compromise. I would study theoretical mathematics. I knew that my father supported me, and I even understood his rationale. We were immigrants with no connections, no wealth, and all we had lay between our ears. A math degree would at least guarantee me a job. A year later, when I told my father I wanted to apply to graduate programs in sociology, he continued to support me, giving advice that I now share with my own students. His counsel often took the form of parables and was laden with examples of people he had seen succeed and fail. What he told me might take a full evening to relay, over wine and my mother's cooking, but the essence was always clear. Write every day, visit your professors with well-formed questions, and always read everything that is recommended, not just what the professor requires. He also taught me to shut up and listen to my advisors. In contemporary American institutions of higher learning, most people would find this instruction quaint. During a time in which the student has become the customer, this sort of thinking is considered anathema. But my father was no fan of the American educational system, so he insisted that I spend my time listening. I owe my father more than he will ever know. In life, love, and work, his wisdom would prove exceedingly valuable. Within a few weeks of my arrival at the University of Chicago, I was lucky enough to meet William Julius Wilson, the eminent scholar of urban poverty. He made an unforgettable impression on me. He was thoughtful, choosing his words carefully, and it was obvious that I'd learn a lot if I simply paid attention. My father's counsel echoed in my head. Listen to Bill, follow his advice, always work harder than you need to. Throughout the course of my graduate studies, I ran into many obstacles, and Bill was always there to guide me. I brought him many typical graduate student dilemmas. How should I prepare for my exams? And some that were less typical. If I find out that the gang plans to carry out a murder, should I tell somebody? More than once I tested his patience. More than once he told me to stop going to my field site until things cooled off. I am one in a long line of students who have benefited from Bill Wilson's tutelage. For his patient direction, I remain grateful. None of this is meant to discount the role that my mother has played in my life and career. She is the most caring and thoughtful person I have ever known. Her voice always rang in my head when I needed to get around a roadblock. Thanks, Mom. I can recall the initial conversations with my sister, Urmila, when I signed up to write this book. I was nervous, while she was overjoyed. She has always productively channeled her enthusiasm by keeping me honest and mindful of those who are less fortunate and who may never benefit from my writings. At the University of Chicago and at Columbia, Professors Peter Behrman, Jean Komaroff, John Komaroff, Herbert J. Gans, Edward Lauman, Nicole Marwell, and Moish Pastone guided me through difficult waters. Cachin Locke, Sunil Garg, Larry Kamerman, Eitan Michaeli, Amanda Milner Fairbanks, David Sussman, Benjamin Mintz, Matthew McGuire, and Barone Pineda were ever supportive, whether with humor, advice, or a glass of wine. Farrah Griffin's writings inspired me to push on. Doug Guthrie encouraged me to pursue the venerable path of public sociology, and Eva Rosen read drafts diligently and is on her way to becoming an outstanding sociologist. I never would have written this book if I hadn't met Stephen Levitt, an economist who took an interest in my fieldwork. Over dinner one night at the Harvard Society of Fellows, Stephen and I spent hours trying to connect the worlds of economics and sociology. To this day, Stephen remains a close collaborator and friend. I couldn't have attempted this act of hubris without his encouragement. Stephen kindly introduced me to Suzanne Gluck, who helped shepherd me through the Byzantine world of trade publishing. Suzanne is one of the wisest souls I have ever met. At Penguin, Anne Godoff has been a pleasure to work with, and I hope this is the first of many journeys under her stewardship. In writing this book, I drew on the intellectual gifts and emotional sustenance of my close friend Nathaniel Deutsch. I pulled Nathaniel away from his precious daughter Simona on many occasions to rant, cry, or just throw up my hands. Nathaniel, I may never be able to return the favor, but I will certainly make sure Simi knows how kind you have been. To Stephen Dubner, I owe an inexpressible debt. Stephen had the unenviable task of helping me put my thoughts on paper. It was not always easy for me to visit my past, and Stephen listened to my meanderings patiently, offering the right amount of criticism and feedback. I doubt that Stephen thinks of himself as a teacher, but he is one of the best. I remain especially grateful to the tenants of the Robert Taylor Homes for letting me both into their apartments and their lives. Dorothy Beatty has been a close friend, and Beauty Turner and the staff at the Residence Journal newspaper have given of their time generously. I still feel guilty about all those years that I let JT think I would write his biography. I hope that he at least reads these pages someday. While a lot of it is my story, it plainly could never have happened without him. He let me into a new world with a level of trust I had no reason to expect. I can only hope that this book faithfully represents his life and his work.
This is Michael Conroy from Harper Audio, and it's my pleasure today to be speaking with Sudhir Venkatesh about his book, Gang Leader for a Day, the audio book version of Gang Leader for a Day, which is being published by Harper Audio. Will be available in stores and online on January 22nd. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Absolutely. What was the genesis of your interest in urban poverty and urban economies? When you went to grad school, were you planning to study those topics? And how did that interest lead you into the research that led to Gang Leader for a Day?
When I went to grad school in 1989, I knew that I wanted to study race relations in America. I knew that I wanted to study social inequality in a general sense, but I had come from a mathematical background, and I really didn't have any direct contact with poor people, or for that matter, with the diversity of ethnic groups in American society. I had grown up in a very, very homogenous, mostly white ethnic suburb in California, middle-class suburb. And so coming to Chicago was just, it was eye-opening. It was like a deer in the headlights in some ways, just trying to take everything in. And I met William Julius Wilson, who largely helped direct me to try and have as close a contact with the people that I was studying that I could. When you come from a mathematical background, you're interested in fancy equations and graphs and statistics, but often you forget about the real people there who you're writing about or researching. And I went into poor communities and I would talk to people and just hear fascinating stories about everyday life in Chicago, fascinating stories about politics and political chicanery, fascinating stories about race relations and interesting moments in the life of the history of African Americans that you couldn't even find in history books. It was all oral histories. It was all these rich tales that existed in the community. And so I'd, on the one hand, be with people getting these rich tales, and on the other hand, I'd be at the university, and there was a disjuncture, and so I figured, you know what, the best way for me to try and really make a contribution is go and try to live with or be with the people as long as I could and get their stories.
The community that you portray in Gang Leader for a Day, it's a very insular community. So can you talk a little bit about how you found acceptance in that community? Outside of your meeting JT, were there other factors that made your research there successful?
So the community I studied was the Robert Taylor Homes Public Housing Development, a project, and it was probably anywhere from 30 to 40,000 people, and it had been built in the late 1960s. And I think that I had probably an advantage over a lot of people studying at that time because I was an Indian. And I think that really helped get access to people and gain their interest, because at the end of the day, I was a curiosity to them and they were a curiosity to me. And I think that mutual sense of wanting to know about each other helped me to get inside, to help me get into living rooms and kitchens and stay overnight at people's places, helped me get a kind of access that a lot of other people weren't able to get at that time.
One of the most unexpected things to me when I was reading the book is the moment when T-Bone gives you the ledgers. I was surprised that there were ledgers in the first place and that he would give them to someone. Why do you think that happened? I mean, it's obviously been a part of your work since then. But why do you think that he chose to do that? Do you have any idea?
So T-Bone is one of these curious guys in the gang who have a lot of options. You know, most people who are in street gangs probably dropped out of school. They probably don't have great chances to get well-paying jobs. They're poor. They don't have great training. T-Bone was in college. He was getting an accounting degree. He knew he didn't want to be in the gang forever. And so I think he had an interest in me because I was a student. And he knew that I was interested in the gang's economic activities, their illegal drug dealing and extortion and things like that, like a student would be. How much money do they make? What do they do with their money? Things like that. And so I think that created a simpatico relationship. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably why he gave those ledgers to me. I think the other thing was that when he knew he was going to jail, when the gang got broken up and the federal police came in, the federal law enforcement was starting to arrest all the street gang members, he knew he was going to go to jail and either be there for a very long time or he was going to die. And I think he felt like this was one of the last acts that he could do on this earth that would redeem himself in a way, so that maybe the rest of the world could see what the gang actually did.
Right. The gang breaking up and the demolition of the Robert Taylor homes. It's kind of a melancholy moment in the book, just because it feels like a community, a relatively tight-knit community, is being dismantled. And there's concern and fear. Is that how it felt from the inside? I mean, did those people, the people that you've kept in touch with perhaps, or whose lives you've kept tabs on since then, have they lost that sense of community? Is that something that's gone now from their lives, or did they build communities elsewhere or fit into other communities in the places that they ended up living?
So I've been following families that I had met in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And after their housing development buildings were torn down, they've been living in the private market. And like most people, I thought, you know, they're probably sick and tired of living in the projects, mm-hmm. and probably sick and tired of seeing each other. So this is a chance for a new life. Some 10 years later, the same families are moving with one another. I mean, this is something extraordinary that you have groups of families who lived in the projects 10 years after they left, still moving to communities together. So imagine not only moving your own family, but moving 7, 8 other families, you know, at a time into a new community. They keep very close ties. They're poor, so they have to share with each other. And some of it is joyous. So every summer there are reunions of families that lived in a particular building in Chicago. So it can be very sentimental and very, very touching. And I think that's one of the things I hope to bring out in this book, is that it wasn't just a horrific place because people were poor and it was neglected by the housing authority. It was a place where it was almost like one big, strong, extended family that is still staying together even after people have left.
I think you do that job quite successfully in the book. You do get that sense as you read it that it's a very interconnected and a very close group of people who are, you know, surviving together with one another. It's actually quite moving. Just one more question. You've written about this research that you did during those 6 years at the Robert Taylor homes. You've written about it in more academic texts. But what made you decide to write a more personal telling of the stories in Gang Leader for a Day?
I think I wanted to write a more personal tale for a number of reasons. I think that, you know, we know about poverty, but we know about it largely through a kind of a cleansed and sometimes detached language, the language of social policy or the language of statistics, how many poor people, how many unemployed, all of which are important. But rarely do we know about poor people from the point of view of someone who went in and broke bread. And so I wanted to try and create that intimate access for people so that maybe sometimes when they're reading this book that they'd forget that they're actually reading about poor people, and maybe they'll think, oh, he's taking us into any American community. I recognize my own neighbors as trying to do the same thing with their kids or fighting crime or finding a way to keep people together. And I had hoped that doing it in a first-person way would help to create that link between the reader and this community, not as I'm different than they are, but, hey, I can sort of recognize myself in what I'm reading.
So let's talk about what you're doing now. Is Are you still doing research into these topics, or have you moved on in your research to other things?
So I'm trying to take a method that I learned in Chicago that helped me to write this book, which is that you go and either live with people or spend a great deal of time with them into a couple of other cities. In New York, I've been studying the underground economy here, people who fix cars on the street or who deal traffic and drugs here, or the sex work economy. I hung out with the children of the very, very rich, you know, another world that we don't really see. And I'm hoping to write a book on that. And then the other big project that I have is based in the suburbs of Paris, another very excluded community of migrants, mostly from the North African countries, who come and try to settle into French society and who live in public housing. And so that's going to be another similar sort of case where I'll go in and spend time with families and try to get their perspective and experiences firsthand.
Well, we'll look forward to those books as well. Thank you very much for stopping and talking. I appreciate it. Good luck with Gang Leader for a Day. It's a terrific book. I enjoyed it tremendously. Well, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This recording was produced and directed by Rick Harris. It was recorded at Harper Audio Studios by Richard Romaniello. It was edited by Valerie Raytron. Mixing and mastering were by Lance Neal.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.